This is the British Forces Experimental Station, Algiers. The time is 6:30 on the morning of December the 20th, 1943. Here is Home Mail, your request programme of musical messages sent specially from your own families and friends at home.
And there we leave our programme of lunchtime music. This is BFBS Cyprus. And now here's today's weather. The ridge of high pressure over the eastern Mediterranean persists, but is weakening slowly. It will be another fine day over Cyprus with light and variable or light easterly winds. Maximum temperatures will reach 24 degrees centigrade, 75...
25 years separate those announcements. One came from Cyprus, and it may be heard any day of the week by 4 or 5 million listeners. The other, well, that was how 1,200 miles to the east, on a hillside high above the old white-walled city of Algiers, we put the very first Army Broadcasting Station on the air. We then moved with the troops into Italy, setting up radio stations on the way in Naples, in Bari, Rome and Florence, and in Austria, advancing all the time with the 8th Army. Now, Forces Broadcasting had its part in the occupation of Northwest Europe, too. In Hamburg began the BFM, the British Forces Network. You'll see that for 25 years this has been a continuing story. Wherever in the world our troops are serving, the British Forces Broadcasting Service carries on today, a link with home. Its role throughout has been anything but passive. Our men certainly knew what it was to be under fire in wartime, as the commander of the station with the 8th Army and the Desert Air Force remembers.
B4 was set up at a place called Cesena, a charming little place it was, and we set up the vehicles in a moat of a 14th century castle. We were only a mile or two distant from the enemy and were not infrequently under fire. We'd be machine gunned and occasionally they dropped a few bombs.
More than 20 years later, the forces broadcasters in Cyprus were on active service while fighting went on throughout the EOCA period. And more recently, the Aden headquarters was under attack.
So about 7 o'clock one evening, we were doing a patrol just in Tawai where BFBS was located. And there was a ginormous bang, and followed by another one, and the locals had put two Belindicides through the roof, and one through the side, and threw a few grenades, and started a little gun battle, which quietened down after about 10 minutes. But it was most shocked, really, us sort of staff inside.
To go back to North Africa, from 1943 onwards, we had two vital jobs to do. The first was to tell our troops the truth about the war, and to make it clear that in spite of those American slanted news bulletins, it was the British who were taking the hard knocks and giving them back. The second was to provide that link with home, more than 1,000 miles away, which proved to the desert veterans that they were not forgotten. We broadcast, and honestly I don't know how on earth we did it, for 16 and 18 hours a day. The same programs their wives, their families and their girlfriends were listening to in Britain. They knew very well that their own people were themselves in the front line and under fire from the air. And it helped to hear this sort of thing.
Can I do them now, sir?
If it isn't Mrs. Mott, the sweetheart of the Sproggs. Now, look, I want you to look after the WAPs when they arrive.
Oh, sir, am I going to be a cipher queen?
Cipher queen? Sounds like a WAP officer with a shocking cold. You'll be cipher as you are. But you must get in. You've got to get into uniform.
It'll be a bit drafty round me undercarriage, sir.
Oh, that'll be all right. You can wear two pairs of blackouts and a window sash.
Laughter when laughter was precious hard to come by. And that was how Forces Broadcasting helped to keep up morale in wartime. Today, the service sends out in Germany, Cyprus, Gibraltar, Malta, Tobruk and Singapore, the modern counterpart of those wartime shows.
It's Top 20 time.
Once again,
John Benson here on this particular place on the dial for another 60 minutes with another 22 of the best, and that means the cream of the pop crop from London Town on this rather parky November week. Number 20, as it often is a new one, and this may be a new name to you as well, Mr. Malcolm Roberts.
That was from a Forces broadcast of today, more than 20 years after Lord Mountbatten went out to Southeast Asia as Supreme Allied Commander and asked for a powerful broadcast transmitter to reach all the 1.3 million men in his command. Well, he eventually got it. It was put up in Ceylon, was called Radio SEAC, and served Burma, Malaya, and all the Far Eastern countries in which we had forces. And this is what Lord Mountbatten has to say of the service as it operates now.
Today, mainly as a result of World War II accelerating development, we have a highly efficient broadcasting service to the forces. This operates wherever they are stationed overseas and has become accepted as a part of the daily life of the serviceman and his family. I'm convinced that this is right, not only because broadcasting is an integral part of life today and therefore has a rightful place in the services, but especially because broadcasting to the forces has an essential part to play in maintaining morale, a factor vital to the fighting fitness of the serviceman.
Lord Mountbatten, and I happen to know that his interest in broadcasting goes back nearly 35 years. When he was Fleet Wireless Officer of the Mediterranean Fleet, that was in 1932, he arranged for the Royal Navy in Malta to receive what was to be the first broadcast by a reigning monarch, the Christmas message of King George V. Now, I'd hardly be human, I suppose, if I didn't want to tell you something about those pretty exciting, rebellious days in Algiers, when, starting from scratch and with an advance party of just three, we built a network of forces radio stations which extended from the foothills of the Atlas Mountains into Austria. But ours was only one part of the tale, and I'll tell you something about it in a few minutes. Memories are all very well, and it's much more important to understand that the service is still a lively and vigorous means of shortening the distance between our sailors, soldiers and airmen, and their own country. Where is the service operating today?
This is the British Forces Broadcasting Service in Cologne, Germany. The time, 20 minutes to 7.
This is BFBS Malta, the British Forces Broadcasting Service.
This is the British Forces Broadcasting Service, Gibraltar.
This is the British Forces Broadcasting Service, Tobruk. The time is 12 noon.
You're listening to the British Forces Broadcasting Service in Singapore.
You're tuned to the British Forces Broadcasting Service, Cyprus.
Well, there's nothing in those places of the desperate, makeshift improvisations we knew in North Africa. These stations, I may tell you, are among the very best equipped in the world. In the past few years, something like £750,000 has been spent on studios, offices and equipment. These days, it's all a smooth, tightly organized operation, and I think you'd like to have some idea of just how it happens. So we drive down to Westminster, turn right by Parliament, and draw up at a big grey government building. Once inside BFBS headquarters, you sense at once the professional touch. The men and women you meet are expert at their job. They work at speed and with a purpose. Just now, they are building a program of popular music. It's part of a series called The 544 Show. Jack Pickering, the producer, with his technical staff, goes about the task of playing 50 or 60 musical items in 1 hour. Yes, it's that kind of show. And it must have its compere, its presenter. So let's have a word with him.
Keith Skewes here with you, literally, just for a couple of seconds, a rundown of what we're going to do. We're going to do an hour's program, which is called 544. A series of 13 programmes which are sent to all British Forces broadcasting stations around the world. We're covering the history of pop music over a period of 10 years. And the reason I'm doing 10 years is purely that I've been in broadcasting like for exactly 10 years next week. I started with British Forces Broadcasting Service in Cologne, went to Nairobi, Aden and a few other hot places, but we won't talk about that. In fact, what I better talk about now is getting on with the programme, because I can see people waving behind the glass, one producer, one engineer, one bunch of records, one compere, and if you're willing to hang around for a couple of seconds, off we go.
Greetings and welcome to the 554 show from London. Keith Skews on parade for the next hour or so with some golden oldies, well-worn winners, revived 45s, call them what you will. Definitely records that we hope will bring back a few happy memories. Now, last week, if you were on the show, or even, in fact, if you were not on the show, we cover the years 1958 to 1960. This week, it's all down to 1961 to 63.
And there's another Forces show in the bag. 1 hour out of the 30 hours of radio recorded every week of the year. Soon it'll be on its way to Europe, the Mediterranean, the Far East. But first the programme has to be copied in the dubbing room at headquarters.
Here's the key skews shows then, Mike, for dubbing.
OK, Paul, thanks a lot. The labels are up from downstairs, are they?
Yes.
As far as you know. OK, nine stations. Let me see, these are going to Cologne, Gib, Malta, Tobruk, Far East, Hong Kong. The Navy, by the way, are taking two of this show. And Cyprus also. Yes, Germany are in fact taking this one at 7.5. Machines are ready in about 5 minutes. Good, okay. Are you happy with the machines,
yes,
Paul?
Yes, like it.
Okay, we'll lace up them and get going if you like.
Deep shelves, a long counter, and large pigeon holes with on them the names of the various stations. Here's the centre of a vital stage in the operation, the dispatch room, and in charge, Mrs. Mary Edwards.
Make it to the Kiskew show.
Yes.
Have you got the tape for Cyprus?
Yes.
Well, will you put a packet straight away there, waiting for it?
Okay, I'll do it straight away for you.
All right. Here was the paperwork.
Yes.
The cue sheet downstairs.
Yes.
Good, but can you pack that and get it away as soon as you can?
And so off goes the tape to the tape library in Cyprus.
Girl,
yes, Paul.
544 show arrived yet?
Let's see. That's the one that's just come in from head office. Yes, here we are.
Well, I haven't seen that before. Let's see what's on the on his list.
Yes, there's quite a lot of pop stuff.
Yeah.
There.
Yes.
Mainly top 20 and top 50 stuff.
As expected. Okay, yeah. Thanks very much.
Fine.
You may wonder why, when the BFBS stations abroad are so well equipped, there's a need for all the bustle and planning in London. Why must all this studio production go on at headquarters? Well, here to give the answer is Ken Doherty, the senior programme organiser.
Well, basically we're here to supplement the material which the stations can produce themselves. They are able to produce most types of programmes. What they haven't got is the expertise of people that there are in England. For example, your disc jockeys, the top disc jockeys are in London, and therefore we use people like David Jacobs, Stuart Henry. In the world of serious music, we use people like Eric Robinson. There's another side to this also, and that is that if you take a program like the Top 20, it's produced once in London and sent out to all the stations. If we didn't exist, the discs would have to go out to the stations, and each station would then have to produce a top 20 program, so that you're cutting the work right the way down by producing it once and once only in England. But really, by far the most important part of our job is to provide a link with home. This is done in a number of ways. There are the newsletter programs which bring local news from the regions. There's our Back Home magazine program which keeps people in touch with events in England. In the sporting world, we apart from producing a very good sports magazine program with all the top sporting personalities to augment stuff which the World Service put out, we send out magazine inserts which bolster the local magazine programs produced on the stations. Then we move on to serious music. Well, now, serious music is a very specialized subject, and not all stations have people who are capable of turning out concert programs, turning out opera programs, so that by producing them here and using people like Ian Wallace, Eric Robinson, and Gerald Sinstadt, we are able to produce serious music programs of a very high quality. All in all, we produce something over 30 hours of programs per week. This is in the region of 200 tapes which go out to the various stations. We only have 9 producers here and 3 studios, so that all in all we have a fairly busy time here stitching things together so that we can get these programs out each week.
It's clear, then, that forces broadcasting stations throughout the world must rely to a great extent for up-to-date material of quality made in London. But this is not to say that they don't broadcast many splendid programmes of their own. Now, because of its place on the map, Cyprus is a key position, and Terry James is senior programme assistant there.
Well, this, I suppose you can say, is the heart of the place, the continuity studio. This is where it all happens, sitting here surrounded by turntables and gramophone records. I would like to add, though, that our life is not just a succession of playing gramophone records. We're a very small staff, I think, as perhaps you'll appreciate, you know, a few announcers working on a shift pattern, engineers also, keeping the place alive and happy. We do much the same programmes as you're hearing in the UK, like BBC programmes around the Horn, the Archers. In fact, we're very reliant in many respects on the BBC for these programmes, as we are for news broadcasts, because obviously we're in no position to prepare our own, being so few. In terms of local programmes, well, we do an awful lot of sport, good example, I suppose, because every serviceman plays some sort of sport, and it goes from badminton to football to cricket to fencing, free-fall parachuting even. In terms of getting with what is going on in Cyprus, obviously women go out shopping locally in the markets and such, and it can be very strange for them coming to a foreign country and not knowing what it's all about. We try to help in this way too by presenting a programme which is called, in fact, Greek by Radio. Just learning Greek, we put this out twice a week, and we find, I think, that this is very useful. There are times, of course, working a shift pattern when, like everybody who has to get up early in the morning, I suppose you dread it because it can be a little bit chilly at 4 o'clock in the morning. It's when you sort of have to get out of bed and come from Famagusta up here to Decalia. It's quite a little drive. And those are the times when you think, oh, goodness, you know, if only I was tucked up in bed at home in England with a nice water bottle, not having to get out at all, but then your shift's over. You drive back to Famagusta, the sun's up, it's warm, you feel pleasant. You know you've done your day's work, and you can go back, and there's that beautiful beach, and it's really warm, the sea is blue. It's a magnificent place to be, I think, Cyprus. One of the, certainly as far as I'm concerned anyway, the nicest island in the Mediterranean. And you can get yourself a lovely tan, sit on the beach, and you don't have to worry about work until the next day. This is marvellous.
And east of Cyprus, at Tobruk, Alan Clough is a programme assistant.
Well, here in Tobruk we've got four announcers, I think, and four engineers. And we serve the service community here in Tobruk itself, and 18 miles up the road at El Adam. El Adam's the RAF airfield. And they, in fact, have their own radio station, the El Adam Radio Service, but TIRS, as they call themselves, and BFBS get on very well together, and there's quite a lot of liaison between us, and they relay some of our programmes. For instance, like Roundabout, which is a programme of magazine interviews and talks, which in fact come from our London head office, so that people out here have a link with home. And I think this is very important, because here in Tobruk, although we get the newspapers and news of England, they come about 6 days, sometimes four, five, 6 days, after the newspapers have been published in England. So I think it's a vital link to try and have BBC news, as well as Radio Newsreel and various news programs, to give people a link with home. Tobruk itself is completely different from any other BFBS stations I've been on. There's not very many. There's no entertainment at all, apart from the radio. And people can't really go out and have a meal anywhere because there just isn't anywhere to eat. The weather is very nice indeed, except in the winter when it gets a bit chilly, when you get what we call here a ghibli, which is like a sandstorm. And in the winter, it's fairly cold, and you get the wet sand and freezing sand blowing in your face on your way to duty in the morning. And then in the summer, the opposite occurs when you get a hot wind blowing off the desert, and the temperature goes up to about 118 sometimes. But the spirit here. Another thing is that the station itself, you have this informality. And not only do you know the people to whom you are broadcasting, but they in fact feel that you are their private property. And if you make a mistake or you present what they consider to be one of their programmes, not one of our programmes, one of their programmes badly, I mean, they'll let you know it first thing next morning. So that people feel that they are in fact a part of the station.
While telling this story, I'm reminded all the time of how it began in Algiers. It's always more exhilarating to run your own war, and up to a point we certainly did that. We bent King's regulations like mad, we pinched equipment, Most of it had been captured in the desert, and we had to blow the sand out of it. And as CO, I was in daily danger of a rocket, if not a court-martial. Nevertheless, it all worked, thank goodness. There had been some forces broadcasting before we turned up in North Africa, but this had been on borrowed time, as it were. So many hours a day were used for this purpose in India, for example, and in Cairo. When I flew out to Algiers with two other officers, just 25 years ago, there wasn't much of a welcome, I must say, for these long-haired chaps from the BBC, as we were known in the officers' mess, although we were neither long-haired nor indeed from the BBC. I was allowed to recruit only men who were wounded, over 30, or who had some disability as a result of shell shock and so on. But we were on the air on New Year's Eve 1943, and from then on we broadcast for at least 15 hours a day, often 18. We were soon in Italy, but always lacking equipment, of course. In Bari we had no stopwatches, so we could only give time signals by training binoculars on the town hall clock. We set up stations in castles and in monasteries, and were on the air in Rome a day or two after its liberation, with the help of a wonderful character, the Cardinal Engineer of Vatican Radio. We kept our troops in touch with home, but there was a propaganda role, as Captain Leo Bennett tells us.
Our programmes varied as much as possible, and B4 was on the air for 15 or 16 hours a day. Later on, we increased this to 18 hours a day. It is true that the 8th Army and Desert Air Force looked on our little station as their own personal property. General Sir Richard McCreary, the GOC, often visited the mobile studio and was, I think, especially impressed by our efforts to maintain local and topical interest. By interviewing at the microphone, pilots who, perhaps only a few hours before, had been shooting down enemy aircraft. It was round about this time that we got ourselves engaged in a running battle with a very smooth enemy character and broadcaster known as Axis Sally. My second in command at the time was Clifford Davis, and we both would argue with her over the air about the accuracy of her German bulletins. "Haven't you heard about last night's raid on London?" she'd ask. And Cliff Davis would reply, "Yes, but you don't say anything about the 175 planes we've just shot down." "Ah, that's your propaganda," she'd say. And so it went on. One thing really infuriated Axis Sally, perhaps more than anything else. She had an extensive and a very up-to-date collection of American pop records. And quite frankly, it was a temptation to listen to them. We evolved a most effective method of dealing with this. We would pick up and relay these records to our own listeners, at the same time having to fade out her propaganda and her jibes at our own news bulletins. Now, naturally enough, this made Sally extremely angry, and she would say, "We know where you are. You can expect a visit from our Stukas today."
And sure enough, come they did. Well, our lot went on and up through Italy, leaving news stations in Naples, Rome and Florence. We had one station near Cassino, and at last crossed the Senio with the 8th Army, broadcasting from Udine. We took over the fascist headquarters, where cigarettes were still burning in the ashtrays and the telephones still ringing. We halted at Klagenfurt in Austria. Then came the assault on Northwest Europe. A forces broadcasting system was imperative, and in charge of that operation was John McMillan. Here's one of his stories.
The four stations were known as BLA-1, BLA-2, BLA-3, and BLA-4. BLA-1 never got on the air under his own call sign during the fighting because the actual unit was used to leapfrog the other three units in turn and so ensure that no station was off the air on any day or night. On several occasions, the leapfrogging was a bit too enthusiastic. On one of them, we leapfrogged right into the Reichswald Forest, where a pitched battle was being fought, and we were ordered back by an angry general called Sir Brian Horrocks. He told us to leapfrog right back again because we were inviting too much attention from the enemy. The war ended, and we changed our role. Now, a static service was required. The occupation forces were way out of range of the BBC. We took over an immense German transmitter at a place called Norden, which is northeast of Emden, and kept on the air a non-stop gramophone record service, which at last was called BLA-1. This was done by two private soldiers and a captain. The two soldiers put on the records and announced the name BLA-1 at quarter-hour intervals, and the captain, Captain Frank Rogers, sat in the control room, his hand on the butt of his pistol, ready to encourage the Nazis on the German civilian staff to keep the transmitter running at peak efficiency. Meanwhile, in Hamburg, a building called the Musikhalle was being converted into Broadcasting House. Up and down the country, signals and Royal Engineers were repairing hundreds of miles of broadcasting cables. A powerful German army transmitter was being moved from the Danish border to a site north of Cologne. Plans were being laid for low-powered transmitters in Hanover, in Hereford, and in Berlin. A shortwave transmitter at Elmshorn was roped into service as well. In exactly 46 days and nights, the job was done, and 4 minutes before 7 a.m. one morning, the last joint was soldered. At the appointed hour of 7 o'clock, we announced, "This is the British Forces Network in Germany." The news followed, and then the first edition of Sunrise Serenade.
The list of celebrities concerned with running the BFN is quite remarkable. It would take far too long to name them all, but among them were singers, musicians, actors, broadcasters, and present-day public figures. The task of the battle-dressed broadcasters went on long after the war ended, and one airman who joined BFN was Cliff Mitchellmore.
I joined BFN in Germany early in 1947 and stayed there for almost 3 years. I didn't push, I didn't shove, I didn't fall. Somehow, like a great many other people, I just drifted in. Eventually, I was posted to the Musikhalle in Hamburg as the officer commanding the Royal Air Force element. I was also, for some unknown reason, made OC Variety in succession to Major Barney Colahan, who came back home to produce Have a Go. Knowing very little about Variety, I had to learn. In fact, a great many of us were learning at that time, because many of the established names, that was Alan Clark, Bob Boyle, Roy Bradford, and so on, had left, and talented but untrained soldiers and airmen were taking their place. Among them, Derek Jones, Brian Matthew, Chris Howland, Keith Marriott, as he then was, now known as Keith Fordyce. But these were still the great days of BFN. 18 hours a day we were broadcasting, news bulletins, plays. We had two orchestras of our own, one under Juan Lossus and the other under Milo Karach. We did outside broadcasts, disc programs, symphony concerts, children's hour, quizzes. We did everything. Among my own personal memories were interviews I had with Ernest Bevin and Lord Tedder and T.S. Eliot. I also remember a commentary on the Neusel-Schmeling fight and, of course, on the Berlin blockade. I also recall after I broadcast the lifting of the blockade from the Helmstedt checkpoint, which I did, I may say, under very strict orders from my BFM boss at the time, one head of the BBC wrote, "Mitchellmore must never be allowed near a microphone ever again, except perhaps to introduce family favourites." Well, thank heavens that he didn't have his way. But perhaps on the evidence of that broadcast, he might well have been right.
Cliff Mitchellmore. Now, it'd be a great mistake to think of this as a European story. You see, Forces Broadcasting had already been going on very successfully, too, in India, in Burma, in Palestine, Beirut, Baghdad, Nairobi. Lord Mountbatten had realized his hope of that powerful transmitter in Ceylon. And of this period, one of today's best-known broadcasters and television personalities speaks with some nostalgia, David Jacobs.
Lord Louis Mountbatten was Supreme Allied Commander in Southeast Asia, and he was starting a radio station out there, and he wanted a naval representative. Well, there were only three announcers in the Navy at that time. One was Bruce Belfridge, the other was John Pertwee, and the third one was myself. It so happened that I was the youngest. This meant that my release date was a lot higher than everybody else's, so that meant I was more worthwhile sending overseas. So I was sent out to Ceylon and became, eventually, the chief announcer of Radio SEAC. Radio SEAC had many people working for it who were well-known names in entertainment today: Paul Martin, Charles Chilton, MacDonald Hobley, Tito Burns, John Hooper, Desmond Carrington, and lots of other very well-known people. There was a rather amusing incident when Lord Louis Mountbatten came to visit us at our station, which was in Turret Road in Colombo, Ceylon. I was an ordinary seaman at the time and was sharing an office with Sergeant Charles Chilton and Flight Sergeant Tito Burns. Everybody else seemed to be officers around me, apart from them, but seemed to have quite high ranks. So when we had our names put on our desks, they put on mine Admiral Jacobs. Seemed to be better than ordinary seaman Jacobs. And on this visit, Lord Louis Mountbatten walked in, and I was, of course, standing smartly to attention behind my desk, and he looked at the name on it, and I suddenly realized that I ought to have removed it before he came in. But he looked at it and he said, "Tell me, Jacobs, do I salute you or do you salute me?"
David Jacobs on the early days of Forces Broadcasting in Ceylon.